On this episode of America First, the Supreme Court is preparing to hand down some of the most consequential decisions in modern American history. Birthright citizenship, immigration enforcement, gun rights, presidential authority, election law, transgender athletes competing in women's sports. Issues Congress, well, they refuse to address, and now sitting before 9 unelected justices. So here's the question America should be asking. Are these justices protecting the Constitution, or have they quietly become the most powerful governing force in the country? Tonight, we take a hard look at the Supreme Court's summer of consequences and ask whether America's highest court is saving this country or governing it. I'm Scotty Nell Hughes, and this is America First. Welcome to America First. I'm Scotty Nell Hughes. You know, for generations, Americans were taught that our government was built on 3 equal branches of power. Now, Congress, they create the law. The president, well, he enforces the laws. And the judiciary, well, it interprets the laws. But somewhere along the way, that balance, well, it began to shift. Congress has become increasingly paralyzed, unwilling to tackle the difficult issues Americans actually care about. And presidents from both parties have relied more heavily on executive orders, often bypassing the legislative process entirely. And as a result, well, the Supreme Court has just found itself stamping into more and more forced to answer questions that elected leaders refuse to resolve. You know, and this summer alone, the court is expected to issue rulings that could fundamentally reshape this country's direction. Questions surrounding birthright citizenship, and whether the 14th Amendment has been interpreted far beyond the original intent. You know, there's cases involving immigration enforcement and the question of whether states or the federal government ultimately controls border policy. Challenges involving transgender athletes competing in women's sports and whether biological fairness can actually be detected. You know, questions over executive authority, federal agencies, election law, and this growing power of unrelated bureaucracies. For years, conservatives have viewed the court as the final defense against progressive overreach. But there's this uncomfortable question many Americans are beginning to ask. Have we reached a point where judges are no longer simply interpreting the law, but increasingly deciding the country's future itself? You know, the founders never intended America to be governed from the bench. Yet, increasingly, that feels like what we're happening. Tonight, we examine what this means for the Constitution, for the future of American government, and for every citizen who still believes elected official leaders should actually do what they were sent to Washington to do. Joining me tonight are two guests who understand exactly what is at stake. Steve Malzberg, conservative commentator, and conservative radio host Malik Abdul. Thank you so much for joining me, gentlemen. It's been a while since I've seen both of you. Great to have you back on the screen. I appreciate it, and I follow both of you guys on social media. I encourage our audience to find you as well, because the commentary just doesn't end when the show goes off. You'll continue to comment. But in this situation, let me start with you, Malik, because this might be the biggest question of them all. We were founded on a system of separated powers designed specifically to prevent any one branch from becoming too dominant. Yet, increasingly, I feel like through Congress, they basically are avoiding these difficult decisions, and presidents are stretching their executive authority further than they ever have before. And Supreme Court, well, they don't have any other choice, but they're left to settle nearly every major national debate. So I have to ask you, has the Supreme Court quietly become the most powerful branch of government?
You know, I actually do agree with your premise in naming just what we supposed to be the separation of powers. I think that you're right. In so many ways, Congress has delegated a lot of roles, not simply to the President of the United States, but they left so many things unanswered that the Supreme Court ultimately has to answer for that. And over the years, and, you know, people look at this now, you listen to Democrats, and many of them say, you know, this is the worst that it's ever been. As long as I've been following politics, the other side, the side that's not in the majority, always has an issue with the Supreme Court, because it always boils down to these type of ideological lines where if you're a conservative, you're going to think that the Supreme Court should do this. If you are a liberal, you should think that the Supreme Court should do that. So I don't think that it's become more powerful. Maybe, you know, if it has, to the degree it became powerful, it really is by default because of Congress refusing to act, and then you have a president going too far with legal questions that the Supreme Court then has to answer.
You know, to Malik's point, Steve, it's a great segue into this, because do you think that the court is overstepping its constitutional role, or is it actually just stepping up because Congress has simply abandoned its responsibility and forced the judiciary into this position?
Well, no, I don't think it's abandoned. I think it's stepping up. And I truly believe that, yeah, and we're doing this show because you're reflecting the feelings that are out there, and that's good. But in my view, if this was a liberal court and they were making all the decisions the other way, now they've ruled against Trump, but if they were making mostly liberal decisions on a liberal court, everybody would be applauding them and cheering them and saying thank God for them. And they're keeping everybody else in check, the crazy president, the crazy Republican Congress. But because they're a conservative court, although they, like I said, they don't always go along with the conservative point of view, that's why it's become an issue. I don't think that, I mean, yes, Congress doesn't do enough, absolutely. But this is what the Supreme Court is supposed to do. I mean, if the president of the United States comes into office and he signs an executive order like he did on birthright citizenship, saying it no more, and a lower court blocks it, then the Supreme Court is eventually going to weigh in on it. I mean, that's their job. And so we'll see what happens. I don't think Trump's going to win that one, even though I think he should. But nonetheless, I think the court is doing exactly what it's supposed to do. What scares the hell out of me is that you have the Democrats openly saying that if they take power, they're going to stack the Supreme Court. We won't recognize the Supreme Court. Then it'll be political. Then it'll be a sham.
Well, that scares you, but Malik, what scares me is the threat that they're going to expand the court, knowing that they're in power and that potentially they might get more justice to it. But before I go to the specific issue, because Steve did bring up the birthright citizenship topic, I have to ask you your perception of it and the fact that, do you think this is just because it's conservatives that are on the court right now, but they don't go with Trump, yet when liberals seem to be in control of the court, they go along with the liberal agenda. It hardly ever goes against what the liberal in office wants. Do you see that same perception?
You know what, Scotty, and I've had this conversation a number of times, and people like to credit this era. Even those Republicans who are critics of Donald Trump, they like to cite this era as, you know, the worst ever for conservatism, and they point a lot of blame at MAGA. But again, I've been following politics long enough to know. Remember, according to Kanye West, George Bush did not like black people. You know, so this idea that there was these glory days where media embraced Republic, it just didn't happen. So sure, because of the court now is largely conservative, there isn't. You are hard pressed to find any issue, especially with Ketanji Brown Jackson sitting there, where the left has said, you know what, well, maybe the Supreme Court had a point here. It is always political. They look at things through a political lens, and every single thing, and in a court that has disagreed with Donald Trump, to the chagrin of Donald Trump and MAGA itself, they still have these feelings about the court, and they are serious. If they get Congress, both the House and the Senate, I absolutely do believe they will move to actually stack the Supreme Court. They said it.
Well, and that's
they it. Said it.
They,
yeah.
They absolutely said they've came out, so we know their plan is. So let's see what the Republicans do to try to counter it. You mentioned birthright citizenship, Steve, and so I've got to ask you. This is an issue that's now before the country. It centers around birthright citizenship. For decades, you know, Americans kind of largely accepted the interpretation that anyone born on U.S. soil automatically became an American citizen. Critics have argued that the 14th Amendment was never intended to actually apply to those who entered the country illegally, and that its original purpose, well, it's been distorted over time. So from your perspective, looking at the law, should birthright citizenship now be reconsidered?
Absolutely. And I'm just discouraged by, if you go back to when the questioning from the justices to both sides' attorneys took place, what we were allowed to hear, you have Roberts and Barrett, you know, asking questions that indicate that they're not on board with changing it. But look, this was after the Civil War. This was after the Civil War. It was done by many historians and legal experts say it was done to protect the children of slaves. Not they never would have done it if you asked them at the time, hey, what about if you have people that are pregnant come here illegally to make their kid a citizen? They'd say, what? Yeah, I mean, please, but that's exactly what's happening. Whether it's illegally entering the country or being on temporary visas, that you have people doing exactly that, and we know that. So I think it, of course, needs to be changed. But I fear that, you know, you can't predict. But if you have to predict, I predict it's going to go against Trump and it's going to stay as is.
Well, it's going to be really interesting if they do, how the reaction goes, how it filters down into everyday America, especially those states that are having to deal with the immigration more than others, which at this stage is almost every state in the United States. Let's move on to another topic because, Malik, the court is also increasingly finding itself at the center of deeply cultural battles. Questions involving parental rights, religious liberties, women's sports, gender identity, and public education are repeatedly, not just once, but they're landing before judges instead of going to local communities or even state legislatures picking them up. Why are these cultural fights increasingly ending up before the court rather than being resolved, I think, through elected representation? Has the courtroom effectively, do you think, replaced the ballot box when it comes to some of these issues?
It depends on the state, because depending on where you are, there are states, whether you're on the left side of things or the right side of things, that are pushing things, that are actually pushing initiatives where they bypass the ballot box. We've seen this a number of times, and it really isn't something that just started now. This has been happening for years, and the reason that many of the activists on both sides of the aisle choose to bypass the legislative process is so it won't be defeated at the ballot box. So I imagine that we're going to start seeing lots more of this, but, you know, to the issue of the trans issue, you know, there are certain states, and I think that conservatives, we have to be careful in how we go after some of these issues, at least on the federal level, because I do believe that there are instances where conservatives, you know, our thing is federalism, states' rights. And I think that some of the things that we may personally, or even from an ideological perspective, like, it actually falls in a lot of gray area that I'm uncomfortable with when it comes to superseding states' rights. And I have those same concerns even with the SAVE Act. And I know we're not talking about that, but that's one of the concerns I have with the SAVE Act.
Well, I'm going to let you share more about your concerns with the SAVE Act and the Supreme Court right after the break. So Steve and Malik, stay with us. Because when we return, for years, conservatives have accused liberal judges of legislating from the bench. But now I feel like that ideological balance of the court has really shifted. So is judicial activism no longer a left-wing problem? And have both political parties become equally guilty of using the courts to win battles they cannot win through democracy? Stay with us. You're watching America First. Welcome back. Tonight we are discussing what may become one of the most consequential Supreme Court terms in modern American history. You know, the decisions coming in the weeks ahead may not only reshape the law, they could reshape the entire political future of the United States. So joining me again is Steve Malzberg, conservative commentator and conservative radio host Malik Abdul. Thank you so much for sticking with us through the break. Malik, before we left, I wanted you to talk about the SAVE Act on it. But before we get to that, I want to talk about, we talked about how conservatives have criticized these activist judges for inserting themselves. Today, many progressives argue that the current court is doing exactly the same thing, only from the opposite direction. So, Steve, I want to go to start with this with you. Has judicial activism become a bipartisan problem, and should the right be calling it out as well?
Well, look, I go back to, and a lot of people don't talk about this, you know, Barack Obama, when he had a fairly, you know, fairly liberal court, Barack Obama was defeated by the Supreme Court unanimously eight or nine times. And people don't talk about that. They make it sound like, you know, he wasn't a radical and Donald Trump is the only radical. But imagine that. It's a unanimous decision, 9-0 or 8-0, 8 or 9 times in that court. So, no, look, I just think that the media is so obsessed and the left is so obsessed the way they talk about this court, the way they portray this court, the way they go after individual justices, the way before the Dobbs decision, Chuck Schumer threatened Kavanaugh and Gorsuch, saying you won't know what hit you. Well, what does that mean? They don't run for election. What does that mean, you won't know what hit you? And, of course, subsequently, there was an assassination attempt on Brett Kavanaugh. So I just think we're in dangerous times when it comes to the court, and I just think that this has always been the case. You know, it's just whichever side is in the minority or gets the decision against them, they tend to sound off more and more. But I think, again, Trump lost. He lost on the tariffs. They beat him on they stopped his tariffs. He had all other alternatives, but they ruled against him. So, you know, I just think the court is being the court.
Well, and in that case, the court probably ruled exactly how they should have, but the American taxpayer lost because we were the ones that had to bear that brunt of that ruling, which brings us to the Save America Act and another policy being pushed by this administration. Malik, what are your issues right now? Because you kind of teased it in the last segment. What are your issues with it and potentially how this could become a Supreme Court battle in the future, depending on how the states handle it?
So if we look just across the board at the numbers, there is overwhelming support for having to show some identification when you go to the polls. When you look at the recent laws, what I think Georgia did in 2005, what Florida did under Ron DeSantis, what Texas has done, they've made in-person voter ID, in-person requirements at the polls. The question is, what do you do as far as the registration process? So what the Trump administration is arguing, or at least their position is that because of federal law, that then states who typically have to, of course, follow federal law, then they have to make certain changes as far as how they register people to vote. So it isn't just simply what conservatives to red states did with requiring you to go to the polls with your ID. They're saying, and even in order to register to vote, to make any changes to vote, and they're doing this under the Real ID system, and that Real ID hasn't been implemented in every state around the country. So I think that for me, this is what the Democrats did when the Democrats under the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, they said that states couldn't be require voters to show ID at the polls. It was a similar thing that Democrats did with forcing states to do things that supersede state authority. And I think that for me, even though there's widespread agreement on the need for ID at the polls and securing our elections, this does seem to be an instance where it supersedes states' authority when it comes to how they register people to vote.
But Malik, to your point, Steve, I'm going to bring you in on this. There is clear laid out, there's clear laws put out as to where states are supposed to have their own sort of free will when it comes to how their elections are run, when they're run, whether they're primaries, what type of system they're set up as. Are we opening up a bigger can of worms when we start looking at some of these voter ID bills? Are we looking at potentially making all elections federalized, where the rules come down from the top rather than each state deciding for themselves, Steve?
I kind of hope so. I mean, I respect states' rights, but when you see what happened in California, you know, with their just unbelievable counting process of the votes, days and days and days and days, and everything changes and ballots accepted. As long as they were signed, you know, they were accepted days after the election. I mean, you just can't have that because, yes, it gives the impression that it's fixed, that it's not on the level. And I'm sure if we looked into it, maybe not necessarily California specifically, we would find, and they have found so many instances of voter fraud, and yet the media always says, oh, no, it's just, you know, an instance here, an instance there's no proof. So in answer to the question, voter ID is the most common sense, and as was appropriately pointed out, you know, they always use the excuse, the pathetic Democrats, that, oh, black people can't get IDs the way that, and black people and brown people and Hispanic people and white people overwhelmingly say, yeah, voter ID. So there's a reason why they don't want it. And when it's that obvious, then yes, I think the federalization of it, it really needs to be discussed.
Well, Malik, I want to bring you in on this because here's, you know, often you see these court cases, you see these things not only go up in the state courts, but also to the Supreme Court, talking about when it comes to the voter. But what's missing, we never have legislation or any sort of rulings or cases that challenges the politicians and their power status. We don't have anything challenging. I don't think it's since Citizens United. Have we had any sort of legislation that have come across and actually gone after those running for office and making sure that they're doing the right thing either? So, Malik, is that also something that you're never going to see? Obviously, the wolf police the hen house, which we'd see in the legislative branch. Could you see that potentially rise up through the states, you think, hits the Supreme Court and see something that might make that work for this to this present age?
Scotty, it seems as if that you're suggesting that there be some type of law that will limit the power of politicians in this country. And I just say, no, that's simply not going to happen. This is the same. Think of Congress. During a government shutdown, your neighbor down the street can go without getting paid. Somebody in Mississippi can go without getting paid. But members of Congress continue to get paid during a government shutdown. During the last government shutdown, I think it was Delta Airlines who had to publicly announce their policy that members of Congress weren't going to be allowed to have an escort so they can get through security. These are the same people who won't even dock their own pay. I have no confidence in Congress' ability to be able to govern itself at all, or that there will be any laws, because you have all of these lobbyists, all of them are connected to members of Congress, so they're not going to push or back really any effort to limit the power of Congress. So I don't think we're going to see many lawsuits, although we should. I don't think we're going to see anything like a Citizens United going through Congress or going through the courts anytime soon.
And to your point, Steve, I even heard some speculation on the Hill that if they try to force term limits on federal elected officials or even at the state level, that term limits would be challenged up to the Supreme Court, that the politician will say it's illegal for you to limit me how many times I can actually have this job. Is this look like we're living sort of like in the upside down Stranger Things type of world here?
Yes and no, because you know what? It comes down to the people. I mean, I don't have a problem. I don't like that, you know, and God bless the politicians who served their whole life in public office. But if it's such a bad thing, and I think it is not a great thing, but if it's such a bad thing in reality, then these people would have been voted out. But then again, the argument could be made that they're in. Once they're in, they're in. And it's hard for somebody to come along like me or you, Scotty, or anyone here and say, hey, I'm going to run against him. He's been in there too
Unless
long.
You're John
because
Cornyn.
You got to get the money. You got to get the money. Got to get the backing. Got to get everything. And that's difficult. I understand that. But when it comes down to push and shove, it's up to the voter. And if the voter keeps electing the same people, then that's who they want.
Or they're not given the choice because those establishment folks have $1 million in the bank starting out when you and I are still trying to pay our electric bills. You know, let's get this back on track. And I apologize for kind of going a little bit off, but because we are in a midterm election year, I think it's important that we discuss election law. But here's the other part that I have a question about, Malik. You know, the founders specifically gave Supreme Court justices lifetime appointments to shield them from political pressures. Now, that was back then. Modern confirmation battles have become these full-scale political warfare, both parties viewing every vacancy as a fight for long-term control of the country. So do you think in this present day moving forward, lifetime appointments should remain untouched, or should we relook at the policy?
I do think that they should remain untouched. And it's not just at the Supreme Court level, if I'm right. I think all Article II judges are lifetime appointments, meaning those on circuit courts. I don't think that there is any type of limitation on them. So I don't have an issue with that. And I think it actually speaks to the larger point of what Steve was making. So I think that there is a benefit, to having people with deep experience on the courts. But I also think that applies as well to members of Congress. I think it's a benefit to having someone who's been in Congress or been in the Senate for like maybe 8 years, or members of Congress for like 10 years, because you do learn lots of things about Senate. And we see there are instances where voters respond, like what happened in Kentucky with Thomas Massie, what happened in Texas with John Cornyn, and what happened with Senator Cassidy in Louisiana. So there are times where voters will hold members of Congress responsible and say that it's time for you to go.
Well, and that comes to our next one. Steve, you have a comment?
Yeah, I was just going to say that, when Kamala Harris made those comments, making public everything that we know that the Democrats are going to do if they regain power, one of the things she said was not only stack the court, meaning increasing the number of Supreme Court justices, but also limiting their terms, limiting how long they serve. So this is something that Republicans, because I think most people don't have a problem with Supreme Court justices doing it the way it's been done. I don't think most people want two states added in Washington, D.C. and Puerto Rico. I don't think most people want to do away with the Electoral College. I know now I'm diverting here a bit. And I don't think most people want the Supreme Court stacked. But that's what they're going to do. They've said it. Where are Republicans every day hammering away at that? Because that will scare people. Yet I don't hear it. And I hope as we get closer to the midterms, for the Republicans' sake and for the sake of the country, they start talking about it.
Well, real quick, yes or no, short answer on this before I let you guys go. Do you think that the legislative branch is now considered to be, they want the judiciary to put up some of these hard issues because they don't want to be the ones on the record for it, because they might have to be accountable for it? So they're purposely making the justice system have to make some of these hard decisions because they don't want to. Malik?
I absolutely do, and we saw that with the Doge cuts.
Right. Steve?
Yes, in certain instances, yes.
Okay, well, there you go. Steve Malzberg, Malik Abdul, two of my favorite commentators in the industry right now. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom on this, and we will see how this summer plays out.
Thanks, Scotty.
Thanks for having us.
Tonight's conversation raises a question every American should seriously think about. Who actually governs this country? Is it Congress? Is it President Trump? Or is it the 9 justices who are sitting inside one very large marble building in Washington? Now, to be clear, the Supreme Court plays an essential constitutional role. But the danger comes when Americans begin to depend on judges to solve the problem that elected leaders, they're refusing to address. Congress was never designed to outsource leadership. Presidents were never intended to govern through endless executive action. And courts were never meant to become the nation's primary policymakers. Yet, that increasingly feels like the reality we are living in. Perhaps the bigger problem isn't the Supreme Court itself. Perhaps the real problem is that Americans have grown so frustrated with Washington, we now trust judges more than politicians. That should concern every citizen, regardless of the party they belong to. Because the founders, you see, they gave us a constitutional republic, not governed by a lawsuit. The coming Supreme Court rulings, they may settle some legal arguments, but they also reveal something far deeper. The federal government is increasingly incapable of governing itself. And if we truly want to preserve constitutional balance, Congress may need to remember its constitutional duty before the Supreme Court permanently becomes America's default government. That should concern all of us. Thank you to both Steve and Malik for joining us and for an incredible discussion. And thank you all for joining the conversation. I'm Skynell Hughes, and no matter what challenges Washington sends our way, we must always remember one thing: America must come first.